The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
I'm going to switch gears with you now. I'm going to go someplace crazy. Ready for this? This is totally, like, wacky, but this is me. You know, you're cool. You are, like, one of the coolest dudes that there is.
Well, I appreciate it, dude.
No, I mean, that is the truth. You watch you, and it is, it's a picture. It's a picture. So I mean, you just exude it. So this is what, I mean, do you know that you exude cool? And I have to tell you something very funny. I met somebody, I know a friend, a good friend who, I can't tell you who it is because you know who the person is, who said to me, he is so cool, he even smells good. Cool. That isn't even the word for it. Oh, that Ricky Medlock, maybe one of the coolest dudes walking. And as you're about to hear, also one of the most honest musicians in the music industry today. Hi, and welcome to the Helicaster Jane Show. I am Helicaster Jane. Today bringing you my conversation with rock and roll powerhouse Lynyrd Skynyrd's and Blackfoot's Ricky Medlock. But before we begin, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get your free audiobook and 30-day trial of Audible.com today by going to our website, HelicasterJane.com, and clicking on the Audible.com icon. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Rock and roll powerhouse Ricky Medlock has been performing on stage since the age of 3. His grandfather, Shorty Medlock, was a well-known Delta blues musician and taught his grandson, still in diapers, to play a miniature banjo. His musical abilities increased over the years. At age 5, he began teaching himself to play the guitar. At the tender age of 8, he was playing drums in Grandpa Shorty's band. Over the next several years, young Ricky would master the banjo, guitar, drums, mandolin, dobro, and keyboards. And let's not forget the voice, rough, raspy, irresistible. Destined for greatness, the kid from Jacksonville made good, first carving his way in the competitive world of rock and roll at 18 as founder, singer, and guitarist for the celebrated band Blackfoot, and then as a member of the iconic southern rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd. Inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a catalog of over 60 albums, sales beyond 30 million worldwide, and their beloved classic American rock anthem, Sweet Home, Alabama. Medlock was also inducted into the Native American Music Hall of Fame and was honored by the Native American Society of North America with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Proud of his Native American heritage, he is never one to rest on his laurels and continues to tour with Lynyrd Skynyrd. But more importantly, Blackfoot is back and touring. And in some ways, at 65 years young, it's as if Ricky Medlock's life is beginning anew. Let's talk. All right, Mr. Ricky Medlock. Phenomenal. That's what I have to say about you. Just phenomenal. I mean, buddy, what a story. You couldn't write this one if you tried. But let's start at the beginning. You were raised in good old Jacksonville, Florida. And first, we got to talk about Jacksonville. You and I, both Floridians. Some pretty well-known and talented musicians, including you, come out of that place. So I want to know, is it the water? What's the deal?
Well, you know, I had often said that many times. Everybody used to say, you know, what was it about Jacksonville, Florida? Because even going all the way back to my grandfather's era, when he was playing, you know, in and out of bands and had his own bands and all that stuff, you know, there was a lot of musicians around Jacksonville. As a matter of fact, when I was quite young, I learned how to play banjo when I was like 3, and I started appearing on a TV show with my grandfather, Shorty Medlock. My grandfather parents raised me, took me and adopted me and raised me starting at about 3 months old. And so when I got to be about 3 years old, my grandfather got me a miniature banjo because I was already showing interest in playing music. And he got me a miniature banjo and really taught me the fundamentals and the basics of it. So he went on this TV show that he was on that originated out of Jacksonville. And at the time, the call letters was WMBR, which is now WJXT. And he was on a TV show there called The Toby Dowdy Show. And what happened was he went on there one time and he told Toby, he goes, "Lee," he said, "my grandson and I, you know, we play some tunes together. I wanted to know if you'd mind if he came on here and appeared with me one time." And I guess Toby said to him, "No, we'd love to see it, you know, and I think the audience would love it, you know." So he brought me on there and we played one song and I was introduced as Little Ricky, you know. And all of a sudden the letters kind of came into the station to the show and it was just an overwhelming response. And I was on there from 1953 through 1958 and I was on there for 5 years with him. And in that time period, I learned how to play guitar. And at the end of that time period, I actually learned how to play drums. But the guitar, you know, I fell in love with playing the guitar, and really that became my instrument of choice.
So I want to go back with you a little bit. I'm going to interrupt. I want to go back. I want to talk about this grandfather of yours, because this guy was phenomenal, as was your grandmother. And the thing about your story that is so heartrending to me is the absolute love you had for these people who raised you. They were, I guess, your father's daughter was your birth mother?
Well, basically, Shorty's daughter was my birth mother, and my biological father was a full Indian, full Native.
Uh-huh.
And he had the affair with my mother when she was quite young, and actually he was quite young, but she was quite young when she got pregnant with me when she was 15, had me when she was 16. And as you well know, back then it was really tough, you know, for somebody, you know, that was not married, and she didn't marry my dad, and he went off and did his own thing. And I guess years later, from what I understand, he got remarried and had another family. But my grandparents stepped in and took me over. And honestly, looking back on it, I mean, I was very blessed and fortunate that they did, because I was born with a serious lung disability, a respiratory disability called bronchiectasis that I suffered with, that I have all my life. I still have it now. And they took a lung from me when I was like almost nine and a half years old.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go into that a little bit with you, because, you know, you have a great story. There's no question about it. But there's been some crap that's gone on, too. And that was part of it. I mean, that couldn't have been easy. And then you become, to my mind, one of the great singers of all time. And we're going to talk about that voice, because I'm going to describe that voice in a little bit. But you had a lot to, you know, you had parents who weren't your parents. You were raised by your grandparents who turned out to be, how lucky are you? But you did have this thing that went on, and that'll affect you later, too. I mean, come on. I mean, you were up against the yin and yang of life.
The thing is that I was very fortunate to have wound up with, you know, my own grandparents.
Right.
And them to oversee me, because what had happened was my grandfather had divorced my mother's actual mother.
Got it.
And had gotten into a new relationship with a lady called Ruby Juanita, and they had fallen in love and they were together. So they were together when I was born, and basically when they agreed to take me, they decided, hey, you know, let's go ahead and get married so that we can make it the right thing to do, you know, in adopting me, because they couldn't adopt me if they were not married back then.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that. And the one thing that I was really fortunate about as well, not only on them looking over me as far as my health goes, but also they let me explore the things that I really wanted to do as far as music goes. They gave me the ability to reach out and grab what I wanted. They gave me the freedom to be able to explore what inner talents that I had that I did not know that I had within myself until much later.
Which you inherited, by the way, from this brilliantly talented man, grandfather.
Oh, yeah. And what was cool is that this guy could play so many instruments, and not only could he play them, but he played them great. And I've always said that I thought that he was far more talented than myself.
Well, that's
in the ability. Well, what I'm saying is in the ability that he was able just to pick up anything and just play it incredibly well.
And you did too. But listen to me. This is something I wanted to ask you. I've been dying to ask you this question forever. With you, with this ability to play so many instruments, and here you are a kid and you're just playing, right? What's interesting? It's you're wired that way. There's no question about it. But what's propelling you, Rick? Kentucky. The sound you could make, the mastery over your fingers and the instrument, you wanted to be like your grandfather. I mean, what did it?
I tell you what happened, and this goes back to what you and I were just talking about in Jacksonville. And you can look her up. Uh-huh. Her name was May Axton, Hoyt Axton's mom.
Really?
And a guy named Tommy Durden. And they wrote a song, and they wanted to get it to, at that time, back in the 50s, a famous rock and roll star. And what happened was, is that they ended up getting an appointment with Elvis in a hotel in Jacksonville. They played him a song, and the song was Heartbreak Hotel. And May and Hoyt and another writer, and I won't say his name because he kind of got ousted from the song, and I'm not even sure he's even alive today. I know that May and Tommy Durden have passed away. But anyway, they played Elvis's song, and Elvis said, I will do the song only if I can have half writership, and which they gave him. They booted this other guy out. They gave Elvis the half, and the rest is history. Now, May ended up sometimes babysitting me for when my dad was off doing shows and, you know, and my mom would go with him and I couldn't go or whatever. I mean, it was just one of those situations. But what was so very, very cool is that it was really funny. I think back on it. And when they played Elvis that tune, they got three tickets from Elvis that night for the show, and they ended up giving my dad the ticket. So we were able, this is when I was six, almost seven, and we were able to go to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville, and here I am, six, going on seven, and I saw Elvis for the very first time. And he came out, man, and it just blew a young mind because I had heard him on the radio. My parents bought me one of the very, very first transistor radios ever in existence, and I used to fall asleep with it under my pillow listening to the radio stations around Jacksonville. And so when we left the show from the Florida Theater that night, I remember my old man looking at me and saying, well, Ricky, what did you think about that, you know? And he would tell you the same thing that I'm telling you right now. I looked at both. I was standing in the front seat of our car between them, and I sat down and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. And honestly, I carried that with me all throughout my troubles with my health. Came 1959. I was operated on shortly before my 10th birthday in February of 1960. The doctors told my parents at the time that I probably wouldn't live to see my 14th birthday, which broke my mom's heart, you know, and of course my dad as well. But somehow,
yeah, here you are.
somebody was watching over me for sure, and now here I am, 65, and I'm sitting here talking to you.
Unbelievable,
you know,
so. Unbelievable. But did you have a real childhood? I mean, when you're that focused on music, and you were focused. And you were still focused.
Right.
You weren't outside running around and you know, playing basketball or this kind of stuff. You the music was it. Is that a childhood? Is that a good childhood?
Well, you know what? Here's the deal. The deal about it is, first of all, I was raised in a very not so great side of town on the west side of Jacksonville. And not a lot of money. So fortunately for me, we had a very tight-knit neighborhood. I played, you know, street ball like the rest of people do. And my problem was I didn't have the help to pursue sports in school and stuff the way a lot of kids do.
So in that sense, music was your savior.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I started playing guitar, and I really got into playing guitar and drums. I studied it. I mean, that was my every waking moment. And of course, my parents told me at a very early age, look, you know what? We will let you do what you want to do. When I got to be an early teen, we will let you do what you want to do. But the only thing we ask, and my old man said, the only thing I ask, get your education. Well, back then, what get your education was, make sure you went through high school.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I did that. I went all the way through high school. I made great grades. I was, you know, and I guess for the most part of it, I guess I was a good student. I mean, I was a good student, I guess,
you didn't
to a
get
certain
in any
point.
Trouble.
You know,
yeah, you didn't get
everybody
in...
gets in trouble once in a while.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean?
Just once in a blue moon. You know,
yeah.
You'd wind up being a quadruple threat as far as you're a genius musician. You are. You were a boy wonder. a savant, I think. Do you ever think about that? Maybe I was a savant. You know, I was like one of those.
I think that I was a, my dad, I guess the way my dad used to describe it was that I was, he said, when you came out of your mom, when you came out of your mom's womb, you were given an extra special kiss by the maker, you know?
That's sweet.
And so what happened was is that I started playing in bands very early on when I was like 10 years old. And I remember the original drummer of Blackfoot Jack and the bass player Greg. We had like a, you know, a kid band. And we'd play sock hops in school and all that kind of stuff, you know. And my dad would come in with his station wagon, pick us up and our little bit of equipment. And,
yeah, and I'll
all that kind of stuff, you know. And I guess we thought we were doing great, you know.
You were not only,
We got to meet girls, and girls would kiss us on the cheek, and, you know.
I was just going to say.
We really thought we were hot stuff, you know.
You were hot stuff. I saw pictures of you as a kid. Yeah, I mean, you're still good looking, but damn, boy, you were just a cutie patootie. I mean, really, you know, handsome as the day is long. She's in that voice.
Well, and what's funny is that then you get into middle school, you know, we called it junior high.
Yeah, I had that too, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, you're in junior high school and you take on this whole look, you know, and and then you get into high school. And I remember the funniest thing to me was that I remember all these really, I call nowadays we call them pinheads, you know, but I remember these, you know, real athletic guys, sports guys that played on the football teams and the basketball teams, and all that stuff saying to me, you know, and guys in school saying, you know, man, well, why don't you quit that, man? You're going to have to get a real job, you know, when you get out of school and so forth and so on. Well, the funny part is that after I had been in Blackfoot and Blackfoot had success, I remember going to one of my high school reunions and I ran into those same people, some of them. And I remember this one guy, he says, wow, Ricky, he goes, you know, man, you've really done it, you know, with the bands there. I said, yeah, I graduated and I got a real job, you know. So,
yeah, you went home and you were able to tell them a thing or two. So listen to me, Ricky, how do you do it? I mean, talk to me about this. Move those fingers with such agility. Is there a zone when you're performing or when you're playing that you go into? I don't know. Are we there? Is the audience even there? Are you someplace else?
I don't think that, you know, Gary Rossington and I talk about it sometimes. A lot of people have asked me, you know, when they see me play the ending, the Freebird, they said, you just close your eyes and you never look at the fretboard.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, well, because I'm at the age that I'm at and I've held a guitar in my hands pretty well all my life and I know where to go with it. And the guitar that I play, all those guitars that I play, I've played them for so long. They're my, they've been my, And I've said this recently, I got a Native American award called the Dreamcatcher Award, a Lifetime Achievement Award, and they asked me about, you know, my guitars. And I said that some of them had been with me so long that they had always been my best friend. They'd been my constant companion. They had been my mistresses. They had been, you know, my girlfriends, my wives, whatever. The only difference between the guitars being that and the real ones, those never left me. And and it's true. I mean, I am at home on a stage. I'm at home with a guitar around my neck, and that's where in life I'm most comfortable. I'm not comfortable a lot of times in doing a lot of different things. I'm comfortable when I go fishing. I love to fish, and it's a way to let go of the rigors of road life and stuff. But where I'm the most comfortable is I'm the most comfortable when I am standing there and I've got a guitar strapped around my neck and I lose myself for that hour and a half.
Wow.
I used to lose myself at my parents' home in my bedroom.
Right.
I would lose myself for hour upon hour upon hour to where, you know, my dad would say, you know, you got to come out here. You got to get some supper. You know, you got to eat.
Are you an introvert?
I would go out on my parents' porch and sit with my mom and dad and visit with them and we'd talk and this sort of stuff. But as soon as that was over, I'd go back and I was right back at it again.
Are you an introvert by nature?
No, I'm not.
You're not.
I'm not really introverted. I'm a very outgoing guy, and I like to. I hope that people. I mean, sometimes you know maybe people might catch me as being that they might think that I'm standoffish, that I'm maybe you know I've got this huge ego or I've got this you know that I'm very conceited and stuff, which I'm not that by far. I just get quiet sometimes. I am very aloof. I can be very, very aloof. I know that.
What's that about?
I know that ex-wives have complained about that. And, you know, you won't tell us what's going on in your mind, in your head. Yeah, but as an entertainer, I know that when I'm on the road, I can be aloof at hotels, you know, because I'm gearing up for that hour and a half that night, you know. But also as an entertainer, I think I'm very outgoing and I love meeting people. I will stop and talk to people and shake their hands. I know that my gal now of 7 years, I have a very beautiful woman in my life. Her name is Stacey Michelle Plunk. She sings with Kid Rock. And she tells everybody, she goes, I can't believe him. When people come up to him and talk to him, he's just, you know, outgoing and friendly and willing to take pictures and so forth and so on. I guess I have an ongoing battle with that whole thing, being very aloof and then all of a sudden I'm outgoing at the same time, but I'm definitely not an introvert. You know?
That's interesting. So this thing with this music is clearly the manna from heaven for you, but what part of the music world has driven you, Ricky? I want to know, was it the fame and fortune? Was it the playing, the singing, the writing?
No.
The collaboration?
I will tell you something.
What?
Holly, what drove me was the fact that I could put something in my hands and there was a feeling that my grandfather told me, you've got to learn this feel that goes from your heart to your hands or from your heart to your voice. And once you get that and you master that, you've got it made. That will take you through whatever you need to go through. And really, all I ever wanted to do, really, to be honest with you, all I ever really wanted to do was just make a living playing music.
Well, you surely did.
I never got into it for the stardom and the fame and the fortune and stuff like that, because really, that to me, that was unapproachable. That was like somewhere that I couldn't reach my hand out and touch. But little did I know, here I am playing in what would become two famous rock groups.
Really?
I played in some early bands, like I played in a band called the Candied Apple, and I played in a band called the Hot Water Blues Band, and I played in a band called the Miracle Sounds, and I played in a band way back, you know, when I was a young kid, the Rockin' Aces. I played in a band called Fresh Garbage, and out of Fresh Garbage, when it teamed up with another band, that became Blackfoot. First of all, it started off as Hammer, and then it became Blackfoot. So I had played in a lot of bands, and little did I know, you know, you don't know those kind of things. Like, pardon me, when I'm sitting there playing with Lynyrd Skynyrd back in the early 70s, and we're at Hell House, sweating our brains out and working 10, 12 hours a day on rehearsals, and all these great songs are coming out of this band, we didn't know. I mean, you don't know that. You're sitting there doing the best you can, and you want people to hear your music, but you never know if they're going to. And the next thing you know, you're sitting on a double, triple platinum record. You've got money coming in. You don't know what to do with it. It's strange to you. And the only people that you can turn to really is the people that you trust, which the people I trusted was my mom and dad and my manager at the time, who really, my manager and his wife, they're still my manager.
Wow.
And my accountant after 38 years.
I guess you can't be prepared for fame, can you?
You can't. I mean, you can't rightfully say, okay, next year I know I'm going to hit it, and I'm going to be sitting on $1 million now, and I'm going to know what to do with it.
Right.
That's so far from the truth. But now I look at it, and I started in life into this long tunnel, and I went into it not knowing what was going to happen. And it was a game of survival and perseverance. And I come out on the other end of it now. And as I look back at it, I take with it all this knowledge that I like to talk to people about, like young musicians and people, you know, that I know and that I meet or something. I got all this knowledge. And if they're willing to listen, I will pass it on. If they're not willing to listen, then they're not worth my time of day.
Right.
So it's called life, you know, and music has really been my saving grace. It's saved my life.
I want to talk to you about this, Ricky, because this is interesting to me. Blackfoot, which is just, oh, my God. You know, you've been in two of the best bands that there are. But with Blackfoot, particularly in the beginning, I'm curious. Did the sound that you guys create, was that your sound? Is that what you had been hearing when you were the three little year old kid playing the banjo, when you were the 8-year old playing the guitar? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I tell you something that happened.
Yeah.
There was three important, maybe four important periods in my life. Number one was seeing Elvis. That's number one. Number two was when the Beatles hit. Number three was when Hendrix hit, followed by the Cream, you know,
right.
And Jeff Beck and Zeppelin. Okay. Those events was very life changing right up through into the 80s. And when I was young, this is great. I remember, you know, sitting in my parents' home, and right before we moved into across town to another home, but sitting in my parents' old home, man, it was so small, and it was a 4-room house built out of cinder block, and I'm sitting in my dad's chair with my guitar in my hand watching Walter Cronkite, and he reported, we're coming right back after commercial to report from our guy in London, England on a phenomenon called Beatlemania. And I was like, what the heck is that? You know, they came back and all of a sudden I'm seeing these four guys running through the streets, and I'm actually seeing them run down a set of stairs behind a building, which would be later on a building that I've played many times called the Apollo in London, England.
Amazing.
And I can take you right to those stairs that I saw. Where John, Paul, George, and Ringo ran down them stairs. And I saw that, and I looked at that, and I went, whoa, what is this? Heard the music. A year later, boom, they're the biggest thing in the world over here, so forth and so on. I saw them in Jacksonville in 1964, 3 days after Hurricane Dora had destroyed Jacksonville.
Wow.
The Beatles agreed to come and still play because the mayor said, it will devastate our city. The people that's bought their tickets, they need an uplift. And the Beatles showed up. They played. Greg Walker and myself were sitting on the field, couldn't hear a damn thing they were playing because the girls were screaming so loud. But you know what? It was the Beatles. Who cared?
Right,
you know what I mean?
Exactly. Been there, done that. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, right.
Then the next thing was, in my parents' car, I'm driving over to my friend Hal Ladigy, who was the drummer of the band I was in. I'm driving over to his house on Interstate 10 heading west, listening to a radio station called WAPE, Jacksonville. And lo and behold, I hear the first opening chords or opening notes to Purple Haze. And when they got finished, they announced it's Jimi Hendrix.
Right. You're freak.
To fast forward to tell you what I did, my little sister wanted to see the Monkees. And I took her, she pitched a fit, and she's 5 years younger than I am. I took her at the time, she was, what, 12, took her to see the Monkees. Hal, the drummer I was telling you about, took his niece. Guess who was opening? Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, my God.
Hendrix was the opening act, and it was the last of the four shows that he did with them.
Wow.
Later on, he came back on his own. I went to see him again, and then I seen him at Woodstock.
Woodstock, sure.
And then I saw the Cream down in Miami. I got to see Zeppelin. I got to see all these phenomenal, incredible bands. Why? Because we had a guy in Jacksonville named Sidney Drashnan who owned a promotion company called Jet Set Enterprise. And he was bringing any and every show through Jacksonville all the time. Almost every weekend there was a concert. And he was catching bands that was on their way down to either Tampa or Miami or on their way back. And it was just phenomenal.
So is what you're saying that input is output, so that what you wind up creating is really the sum of all the parts of all the pieces that have put into your brain, and then it kind of becomes Ricky's, and then Ricky spits it out, right?
Absolutely. I mean, when the four, Blackfoot started off as a five-piece band with a keyboard player, and we lost him up in Jersey and because he wanted to go with another band, he quit, and this and that, and we kept the four of us. all of a sudden, with the four of us, it was two guitars, bass, and drums, and between the four of us, we started formulating that sound.
So it's collaborative, too. And I'm glad that you said that, because I want to ask you this question, because this comes up. You know, I do a lot of interviews with, you know, you got you kind of guys, you music boys, and women. And the thing that is interesting to me is that Blackfoot breaks up, which is not unusual in the rock and roll world, right? And I wanted to ask you, business collaborations and rock and roll, no matter what anybody wants to say, it's a business, right? They're never
That's
easy.
Right.
They're never easy. They're not easy in any other business, but they seem to be specifically difficult in the world of rock and roll. And I want to ask you about that. Why do they often prove to be disastrous relationships? Is it the stress?
Well,
is it the...
look, I, you know what? Here's the deal.
Okay.
The very first time I left Foot to go join Lynyrd Skynyrd was a thing that we had a woman who was the manager of the band, and she was involved at the time with the late Jackson Spires.
Right.
It was kind of a self, one-sided thing, and I got frustrated because it wasn't going anywhere, and I got frustrated, and I wanted out, and I randomly happened to get a hold of Alan Collins, and he gave me over to Ronnie Van Zant. Ronnie said, "We need a drummer. Do you still play drums?" I said, "Yeah." And she, now they sat on a set of drums, and oh, God, I didn't know how long. But I brushed up on it, and a week later, I sold off some equipment, took what I didn't want to sell, my guitars, my luggage, shipped my guitars home, and they sent me a plane ticket. And a week later, I was sitting on a set of drums rehearsing what would become Lynyrd Skynyrd's first and last record, or the Muscle Shoals sessions of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
You are listening to the Hallie Kessler Chain Show. Today, my guest is musician Ricky Medlock. The Hallie Kessler Chain Show is always available online at HallieKesserChain.com.
And I played off and on with the guys from 71 through 73. Then in 74, Foot reformed again. Jack come and found me and said, "Charlie and I and another bass player are up in North Carolina, and we're wanting to put the band, would you, you know, consider coming up singing in front of the band?" Yeah. So I did it again, off and running. Then that bass player, he left, and Greg came back in, and there you were. There, I mean, we spent, you know, we spent from about 1974 all the way through 1985, you know, just running up and down the road, having records, having hit records. And honestly, to be real frank with you, I think what happens is a combination of business, jealousy, the collaboration, yes. But I think that a lot of personal things get into the middle of it, involved. I think people get hurt feelings. And what ends up happening is it causes the separation. And basically, to this day, right now, I'm sorry, you know, I'm not apologizing for myself, but I'm sorry that it took that turn. I didn't want it to take that turn, but Blackfoot had went up, it came down, and I found out a lot of things that was told to me that really just cut me like a knife. And
I'm done.
I'm out of here.
And then
basically right now today, you know what? I got no feelings, man. I mean, that was so long ago, and I've moved on in my life, and I'm where I really want to be. I am.
Well, what I was going to say to you is that I wasn't asking you because of you specifically what happened with you. I was asking you in the collective, right? And I think you understand that, but I think that people need to understand that you were also pretty damn young, a lot of success very young. So these things, you know, I don't know. I think that the music business is tough, not just tough to get to the top, but tough to navigate.
You give a 27, anywhere from 21 up to 29-year-old hit records. Think about what I'm telling you right now. All of a sudden, I am 28 years old. I've got a triple platinum record with Lynyrd Skynyrd after the plane crash happened. That's when the first and last record came out. I'm sitting on a triple platinum record, and I had songs in there that I had written and that I had sang on. And then all of a sudden, I'm sitting on platinum success with the Strikes record.
Maybe.
And it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So think about it. When you hit a young mind like that, it will do things to you. You feel invincible to the ways of the world. Then all of a sudden, it's the women, and it's the drugs, and it's the booze, and it's the running up and down the road month after month after month. Hell, honey, from the time the Strikes record came out and we hit the road and toured on the Strikes record, made the Tomcat record, and toured the Tomcat record, we had been out 22 out of 24 months. That's a long time.
Amazing. I'm going to switch gears with you now. I'm going to go someplace crazy. Ready for this? This is totally, like, wacky, but this is me, and this is, you're cool. You are, like, one of the coolest dudes that there is.
Well, I appreciate it, dude.
No, I mean, that is the truth. You watch you, and it's a picture. It's a picture. So I mean, you just exude it. So this is what, I mean, do you know that you exude cool? And I have to tell you something very funny. I met somebody. I know a good friend who I can't tell you who it is because you know who the person is. He said to me, "He is so cool. He even smells good."
Well,
what's the deal, buddy? How do you get to be that cool? Just tell me.
Well, the deal about it is that I think that in a small way, I emulated guys that I really just, was such huge fan of. I mean, there was nobody cooler than Elvis. There was nobody cooler than George Harrison. There was nobody cooler than Hendrix and Clapton and Jeff Beck and the guys in Zeppelin, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and all these guys. And then, Paul Rogers of Free then. And the deal is when you see these guys and even some of the black blues artists, man, of our day, of those times. I mean, Keith Richards to me, ultimate coolness. And I am such a huge Keith Richards nut,
Yeah.
But it's so funny. I
don't know.
I go back and I even look at, like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and all those goose. Too cool. So you want to try to be in their company. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think you were just born cool.
But then all of a sudden you find yourself just being what you are. And when you walk into a place, you want to be nice to people and you want to speak to people. And if they're friendly to you and they show the respect to you, you'll show it right back. If they don't, I don't want to waste my time. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but I also think you were just born cool. You're totally born cool. But listen to me in the interest of time, because I'm watching that clock and I got a lot more to go. I want to ask you this. Is it true? Because this is something that I read, and I didn't know whether this is the fact that when you left Lynyrd Skynyrd after the first time, it was because you just didn't have the stamina to play the drums because of the cystic fibrosis thing. Is that true?
Well, that is
story?
True. Yeah. I could play great. I mean, well, let's put it this way. I knew that I was a good drummer with them. I just didn't think that I was a great drummer with them.
Really?
And I was honest with myself, and I was honest with the guys. I said, you know what? You guys are going to need somebody of great stature. And I think, honestly, at the time, I think Ronnie, at least maybe when I cross over one day, I get to see him and he tells me I'm right, because I think that Ronnie respected that and respected the honesty.
Wow, I never knew that part.
And I knew that I wanted to play guitar. I wanted to sing. And I knew that they needed a great drummer instead of just a good drummer to take them further. And what was real interesting, my old man said, realize the decision now you're getting ready to make, because that band is going to go someplace and do something. Fast forward, Ronnie invited me to travel with him in 1977, in October of 77. He invited me to come ride with him, and I all of a sudden couldn't do it. I had gigs come in that, with Blackfoot, and lo and behold, look what happened,
Unbelievable, right?
So fate and a guardian angels, have their way of working their magic,
Exactly, you never quite, it's never a straight shot. It comes in all sorts of crazy ways, and I know that.
That's very true.
Listen to me, you wanted to be an actor? Did you do some acting with Shatner and on his show or on TV?
Oh, I've done quite a bit. I've done...
Cool. See, it's cool.
The funny thing is, I studied in high school in drama class. I was in drama and did some plays in high school and stuff. And I had an opportunity. I had an agent out in Hollywood that was at the time and said, I will help you get in with all these people that I know, casting directors and casting agents and producers and stuff like that. And I must have did 150 auditions. But Hollywood is a very interesting deal. I mean, I don't think that I quite fit their persona. I did, oddly enough, I did a movie with William Shatner called Groom Lake.
Right.
I did another movie with Katherine Heigl and Tom Sizemore called Zizek's Road. I did another movie that Sigourney Weaver was in, stuff like that, called Into the Night.
So you have a fallback career if all of this goes to hell in a handbasket, right?
And the funny part about it all is I did Nash Bridges. I did a season of Nash Bridges, and I did some voiceovers and commercials and so forth and so on. So, I mean, I did that, and I kind of wanted to do it more. But all of a sudden, one day, I had gone to, I had talked to Billy Bob Thornton about this because Billy's a friend of mine. And I had talked to him. He says, Ricky, you just need to stay on it. And, he and I had talked about working together, and something happened there to where it just kind of never happened, because I was supposed to do this movie with him and a couple of other Hollywood A-listers and stuff. I'll tell you what I ended up, I almost was the part that Scott Glenn did in Training Day with Denzel Washington.
Oh, wow, really?
And I had the role. It was between Scott Glenn, and it was between, what's his name? I forget what his name is, and myself. There was three of us. And if they had to turn the roll down, I had it. But Scott Glenn took it.
Wow.
And, I was in with some pretty powerful individuals. But it was really funny. I came at these people as a real strong person. Like in Zizek's Road, man, I got the part only because the part called for being a not-so-good person, and I end up killing people in it and all this stuff, but which I'm believable at that kind of stuff, I guess. It's funny, you turn into this character, and I can turn into the character, and I love to do that once you get dressed up and you look the part and so forth and so on, but all of a sudden one day I woke up and I'd gone for so many auditions and just got right there at it and knew I was perfect for it, only to be turned down by somebody that, in my book, they were talented, but they didn't have that thing really that I thought that needed, that the part needed. Now, I got frustrated, and I remember one of my vehicles was a travel van, and I remember waking up in the place where I was staying, and I said, screw this. I'm in one of the world's biggest bands, and I don't need this. I'm going. I'm out. Huh. And I called up my agent out there, and I told her, I says, I'm done. I'm out. And she was freaking. I mean, I was like, what? Wait a minute. I went, no, yeah. I'm not waiting. I'm out.
So speaking of, right.
I packed up that day. That afternoon, I hit the road, and I came home. And I never went back.
So you're speaking of walking away.
I didn't think that I wouldn't succeed at it. I just wasn't going to play the mind games and the bullshit games that they like to play. That's it,
So speaking of walking away or checking it, did you ever just want to check it all, just say, the hell with it, I'm going off and I'm going to go to that dock and I'm going to put my rod and reel in that water and I'm going to fish till the cows come home?
No, because like I was saying to you a little while ago, I'm the most comfortable when I'm playing guitar. And I don't think there's such a thing. I don't really think there's such a thing as like giving it up. If you give it up, then you never really loved it anyway. I just mentioned Keith Richards and the Stones and stuff. I mean, the Stones and AC/DC and Aerosmith and Us and ZZ Top. There's a lot of classic bands, man, that are out there just still, playing their shows and doing it on a year-to-year basis. Why? Because they love to do it. I mean, that's what I do. Music is what I do. If I gave that up, I'd go mad. I'd probably be in some serious, serious trouble. I love to fish, but you can only do so much fishing. And I just love to do it, Holly. I mean, I've been a musician all my life, and I'm always going to be one,
Yeah, because when the music over, old Jim Morrison used to say, just turn off the lights, right?
I mean, yeah, that day, I don't want to see that come too soon, believe me.
No, I get that. And I'm with you, buddy, right? You got a lot more to give anyway. Listen, you're in reinventing the wheel. You're always reinventing the wheel. That's what makes you so terrific. And I just love it. Blackfoot is back. In fact, folks, if you're in Salisbury, Massachusetts on November 19th, Blackfoot will be at the Blue Ocean Music Hall and at Seneca Casino in Niagara Falls in New York on November 20th and at the Beacon Theater in Hopewell, Virginia on November 21st. I mean, really, how amazing is this, Mr. Producer? I mean, this is a trip.
Well, here's the deal. I think that producing a record, and I've always wanted to do that. My manager would sit right there and tell you he's always, you know, bugged me and wanted to do this. We have a studio here in Fort Myers called Studio C, S-E-A, like the C, and I have a mix room at my house. And the idea came, how it formulated, the idea came from when the original Blackfoot guys were out playing under the name, and when the agreement ran out, they didn't want to up the agreement, so the name came back to me. And so therefore what happened was one of our partners, Eric, a guy by the name of Eric Liebel, he came to Al Nally and I, and he said, I have this idea. And he told us about starting a Blackfoot with all young members. We had heard that Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley had been talking about doing this for years. All of a sudden, now, look at who's doing it. Farner. Mick Jones is doing it with Farner and goes out and plays with them every once in a while. We decided we were going to give it a shot. And there was a couple of guys in town here, the guitar player Tim Rossi and the bass player Brian Carpenter. And they were in bands, in a band, you know, they had their own little trio going around town, and killer musicians. I'm talking about, like, really phenomenal. And then we got them recruited, set forth, looking for a drummer. Finally found Matt Anastasi. He fit. Then came the real challenge of finding a voice and finding a singer. And finally found, Tim found this guy, Jeremy Thomas. They put it all together. They put it in a bowl, mixed it up, and we got busy writing. I co-wrote half the songs with the guys, but the agreement was that I would only go for this if I could produce the record, and because that's what I'd always wanted to do. And lo and behold, just finished up the record here at the end of the summer going into fall, and it's ready. And we're negotiating with the company, and hopefully right after the first year, you know, there will be a new Blackfoot record emerge. And I am, you're right, I got a shot to go out with the guys and guest star with them for these three shows coming up, and it's phenomenal. They come out, they play 45 minutes of the classics and some new stuff, and then I come out for 45 minutes to 50 minutes, play more of the classics and a couple of new ones. And there you go.
Oh,
and we
how
have
fun.
Some fun.
Yeah, really. How fun is this? Oh, I wish I could be there. Oh, my gosh. Are you going to record, tape this thing, these things?
Oh, I'm sure they're going to. Yeah. It's funny. They're already talking about doing all kinds of stuff.
Oh,
I can just imagine.
Let me ask you this. Working with these young guys, is it a trip for you? Does it just give you new blood, just get your fires going? I mean, it must be fun as hell.
Well, it's really funny because they look at me like, you know, when we first got into rehearsals, you know, they were like, whoa, we're standing here playing with this guy? Really? You know?
I bet.
And what was really cool is that Tim and I, the guitar player, what a phenomenal pair of hands he has. I would put him on the level, honestly. I would put him on the level, and until you see him, you might not, you know, but take it from me. I put him on the level of like a Joe Bonamassa.
Wow.
And this guy is a virtuoso. He's phenomenal. And the thing that's interesting is you put both of us together with his style and my style, and it's so powerful. So, I'm just looking so forward to this. You know, it's going to be great. It really is.
Yeah, I bet it is. I'll bet it is. Listen to me. 20-odd years, right? Leonard Skinner, Blackfoot. I mean, where does the time go? I'll bet you're asking yourself that a lot.
I know where it went. It went with Leonard Skinner, you know.
So two things have remained steadfast, you and the quality of your music that you produce. So what about fans? Do fans change? Have they changed? Have audiences changed?
I think that what has happened, you know, I got some pretty heavy hits on the internet when I said, Johnny and I were doing an interview lately, Johnny Banzat and I, and I said there's no more guitar heroes.
Whoa.
And you know, I said there's a lot of great guitar players out there today, which there is. Joe Bonamassa, I just mentioned him, and I've known Joe since he was 16. I went and jammed with him here several years ago, and he said it right out. He said, this guy's always, I've always had a lot of respect for this guy. When I used to play, you know, shows with him, he never was really, you know, bad to me, and you know, come down on me for anything. He goes, and he's just a dear friend, you know. And I've known Joe since he was 16. And Joe went from being this kind of guitar player to, whoa, this kind of guitar player.
Right.
And just phenomenal. But I said, nobody has come in to change the face of the electric guitar since Eddie Van Halen.
Mm.
And if you think about it, think about what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
You went from Eddie, and then all of a sudden it went through the grunge, and then it went into hip-hop, and then it's gone into pop country and all that. But who has emerged as a guitar player that changed the face of the guitar like Hendrix did, Clapton, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and or Eddie Van Halen?
You know, I agree with you, but why do you think that is?
I honestly believe that... I have a couple of different thoughts on that. I think that every song that has been written or that can be written has been written already.
Oh.
I think that anytime you write a song, you're going to hear another song in it, or maybe two. I think that people growing up, young musicians, they want that instant gratification right now of learning the guitar just well enough. And I'm not putting them down for it, because if that's what they want to do, then that's fine. But they want to learn it well enough and good enough to put a band together, to have records out, to tour, and that's it. And there is no person that emerges out of that. You can't emerge out of that. You got to have a freaking love affair with your instrument.
Right, right.
It's an ongoing love affair with your instrument. And if you don't have that love affair, it's just going to be an instrument as a tool, and maybe you will hit it with one record, maybe you'll get two if you're lucky out of it. Fortunately, I was grew up in a time where it was all virgin territory. Every song that could be written had not been written yet. And, you know, we were very lucky. We were very blessed and very fortunate to grow up in that kind of time.
Right.
Now, you know, I look at it, and I turn on, if I hear a song, I go, okay, there you go. You know, do I hear a great guitar player? No, not yet. But I tell you what I do hear. Now, I hear vocalists. One of my favorite vocalists of the era is Chris Cornell.
Hmm.
Chris Cornell, to me, is just off the charts, in my opinion.
He's not you, though.
I beg your pardon?
I said he's not you.
Well, I mean, no. I mean, I'm different, but...
No, I hear you.
When I start listening to people, if I get a great vibe from them, I go, you know what? I'm giving him his just due.
Oh, he'll be thrilled to hear this, I'll tell you that. I've got two more questions that we've got in the interest of time, so play with me here, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Why did you survive? So many come and go, not you. You're 65 years old. You're at the top of your game. What's the deal?
I had a want and a need to play my music. I had good people around me who really gave a damn about my life and cared about me. I was very fortunate to have that. And now that I am 65, I still have people around me that I enjoy being with. We all care about each other. My manager and his wife, who's my accountant, they were like family. I mean, after 38 years, I mean, my God, you know, going on 39 years now. I'm in a band that we're a big family. We care about each other. And we go out every night and we play it like it's going to be our last. And we smoke it. You know, we're not going to be denied. I survived because of my love for the guitar and music. That's how I survived.
You once said, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse.
Oops. I guess I failed at that.
Oh, get out of here.
Well, you got to understand something, Holly. Think about it. When I made that statement, I was probably high as five kites and had a pretty good bit of drink in my system. You know?
I don't know. I think it sounds like a damn good way to live.
And when I rejoined Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, my old man, Johnny Van Zandt, asked me, he says, why in the world do you want to come back to us? Because you were the front man and the lead singer for a band. And I told him, I said, I'll leave you with this thought, Johnny. My old man told me, you'll never get to drive the Cadillac unless you can ride in the back seat. So I told Johnny, I said, I'm in the back seat. Let's go.
I've been speaking with the great singer, songwriter, musician, producer, Ricky Medlock, of the bands Lynyrd Skynyrd and Blackfoot. Lynyrd Skynyrd is out with a new album, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, and second helping live from Jacksonville at the Florida Theater on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital format from Eagle Rock Entertainment. And Blackfoot will make 3 special appearances, November 19th, 20th, 21st. For further information, visit their website at blackfootband.com. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ricky Medlock, and I hope you'll tune in every Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the Hallie Kasser Jane Show by visiting our website at HallieKasserJane.com. Up next, a conversation with author and musician Warren Zanes, out with a brand new book that has a lot of buzz, Petty, the Biography. This is some book, folks. I just finished it, and wow, wow, wow. And also with us, the Queen of Crime, Miss Patricia Cornwell, out with her latest Kay Scarpetta novel, Depraved Heart. So, until we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser Jane. It's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.